stimulus and thereby allowing them to learn and appreciate alternative and healthy scenarios. Replacing drinking with running can be so effective that people who have done so quip about becoming addicted to running rather than alcohol. She might not call herself addicted to running, but Heather Johnson is an example of someone who used running to help overcome substance abuse. I started running in 1998, the year that I stopped using alcohol as my crutch to manage anxiety and to dull panic attacks enough to live life, the South Portland, Maine resident says. During my first year as a recovering alcoholic, I had so much pent-up adrenaline, my head spun nonstop with thinking about drinking again, and I had to do something. I started walking daily, and when I couldn't walk fast and far enough, I started to run. Johnson has remained sober for the last 20 years while running marathons, becoming a mother of three, and working in marketing. Whereas she used to turn to alcohol to manage her lifelong anxiety, she now runs. Being a runner not only provides Johnson relief, but gives her healthy practice in managing anxiety. Running continually puts me in situations where I have to get through it, she says. It's strange, but running probably puts me in more anxiety-provoking environments than anything else I do. It's constant practice to push through and accept the unknown. I'm sure it's created new neuropathways that have been intuitively applied to other areas of my life. Running also helped Ryan Rathbun overcome a drinking problem. The Chicago resident says that he was a typical binge drinker in college. Nothing during the week, get all your schoolwork done, then drink. He continued that pattern when he started working. But then it started slowly creeping in a little more weeknights, having one or two drinks here, one or two there, and it got to the point where I was having four or five drinks every night, and then still binging on the weekends. As we saw in Chapter 5, Rathbun had occasionally been on antidepressants in high school and college, so he knew depression was a problem. But he disregarded it and the severity of his drinking. I was in the mindset of, that's just me, that's what makes me cool. After an ultimatum from a romantic partner, Rathbun made big lifestyle changes, including resuming the running he'd done in high school and college. Running contributed to a concatenation of positivity, eating better, improved relationships, better self-image, weight loss, and he succeeded for more than 5 years in leaving heavy drinking behind. I have a completely different relationship with alcohol, he says. Now I can just have a glass of wine with dinner or go out and have a drink or two at a bar. I don't worry about trying to keep it in control because it just happens naturally. Not all running and drinking stories are as straightforward. The other side of running and drinking. More than 20 years ago, a study out of the University of Virginia and the Dean Medical Center found that runners drank more than their non-running counterparts. On average, the male runners drank 3 to 4 times as many beers per week than the male non-runners. When researchers at the University of Florida reviewed available studies on the topic, they found that drinkers of all ages were more active than non-drinking peers, and that drinking and time spent working out increased together. Findings were contrary to the hypothesis of the investigators, the researchers admitted. A Penn State study found that positive correlation between activity level and alcohol consumption exists on an individual level. The people tracked in the study drank more on their workout days. According to Frank Brooks, about 10% of the population will develop a substance abuse problem serious enough to call for intervention. Combine that stat with the aforementioned research, and you can see that the intersection of running and drinking can be different than Rathbun's and Johnson's experiences. Steve Cartalia of Westminster, Maryland, describes that other possibility this way. There were times when I would drink too much the night before, but I'd figure, I still have it under control. I got up and ran 12 miles. That's the runner's version of heavy drinkers' self-delusion, that they don't have a problem because they've never missed a day of work. As clinical psychologist Laura Fredendall notes, People at a high level in fields across society have problems with substance abuse. In some of those fields, creative endeavors, food service, sales, the underlying behavior is part of the culture. In other areas, including running, the correlation can be more puzzling. Yes, was Brooks' one-word reply when I asked him whether he was surprised to treat serious runners for substance abuse. But if you know enough running history, you can think of ways in which heavy drinking has been tolerated or even celebrated in running culture. I've already mentioned the beer tents, event sponsorship, and positive coverage of beer miles, which are essentially exercises in binge drinking and running. On the elite level, Frank Shorter famously enjoyed 2 liters of German beer the night before he won the 1972 Olympic marathon. Former American record holder Steve Prefontaine is widely believed to have been drunk when he fatally crashed his car in 1975. The ethos was best stated by 1972 Olympic medalist and 1983 New York City Marathon winner Rod Dixon when he said, "All I want to do is drink beer and train like an animal." This isn't to say that Dixon or others from the era had a drinking problem, although former marathon world record holder Steve Jones stopped drinking more than 15 years ago and is writing a book that will include details of his history with alcohol. Nor is it to ignore the multitudes of runners who drink in moderation and simply find beer to be a refreshing post-workout quaff. What's significant is that since at least the first running boom in the 1970s, alcohol's presence has been taken for granted in running publications and among runners. Cartelia was a high school and college runner in the 1980s and went on to record personal bests of 28 minutes 32 seconds for 10K and 2 hours 18 minutes for the marathon. He says, "It seemed like it was a highly respected, cool thing to be a hard drinker and also a badass on the track." A British study offers some insight on why hard training and drinking immoderately might coexist. It found that people drink more when they've done something leading to ego depletion, or when your self-control resources are temporarily drained. Ego depletion can occur after a trying mental or physical task. In running terms, it can be expressed as, "I used up a day's worth of mental capital getting through that track workout. Now it's Miller time." When you're running 100 miles a week, including a hard session every few days, it's easy to feel that way more often than not. Also consider such research as a massive Dutch study on more than 19,000 twins and family members. Among its findings was that the regular exercisers scored higher on measures of sensation-seeking, interest in new experiences, susceptibility to boredom, etc., which has been linked to alcohol use. At root, we runners aren't the grim Puritans many sedentary people take us for. Another aspect of psychology might underlie heavy drinking in runners, and it points to why the behavior can often be seen at least as much in the front as in the back of the pack. Serious running attracts and rewards some of the same personality traits that can get you in trouble with alcohol. A more is better approach to things, the mindset that if you're going to do something, then you should fully commit to it, and a tendency to explore boundaries rather than be content with good enough. People who are the souls of moderation tend not to win races. We wouldn't want to call that obsessive as much as an enthusiasm for pushing the limits, Fredendall says. And then there's depression and anxiety. The either-or perspective of life as a drinker or life as a runner doesn't reflect many people's situations. Jokes about replacing one addiction with another ignore the possibility of a yes-and approach. Yes, some people want to get a certain feeling from running, and then they want to continue and compound that feeling with the help of alcohol. Remember the stats about 20% of people with depression or anxiety having a substance abuse problem and vice versa? According to Brooks, of those people he sees for help with substance abuse, almost all have underlying depression and or anxiety. Is it so hard to believe that such people can simultaneously lean on running for relief from their mental health symptoms while also self-medicating with alcohol? In terms of what the brain gets out of it, it's very similar, Fredendall says. That was my experience for many years. My time as a drinking runner. I started running in 1979 as a ninth grader, a few months after I first got drunk. I have a distinct memory of two experiences from that time. First, splitting a quart of Schlitz malt liquor with my friend Bob, then standing in awe as an unfamiliar feeling of euphoria washed over me. Second, sitting on the porch after my first 10-miler and noticing that the drained elation I felt was also something new and welcome. In Chapter 4, I mentioned seminal psychologist William James's phrase, the yes function. Here's the first part of that phrase used in context. The sway of alcohol over mankind is unquestionably due to its power to stimulate the mystical faculties of human nature, usually crushed to earth by the cold facts and dry criticisms of the sober hour, James wrote. Sobriety diminishes, discriminates, and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. It is, in fact, the greater exciter of the yes function in man. For a long time, that James quote described my relationship with alcohol. I was what you might consider an enthusiastic social drinker. I didn't drink most days. I didn't drink alone. I didn't stockpile drinks or plan drinking. Like most people, I could take it or leave it. But when I drank, boy, did I enjoy it. There were things I liked better about myself when under the influence. I was nicer, less sarcastic, more generous, more forgiving of others' foibles. Being buzzed was akin to how I felt running most days, a heightened sensory experience and a short, pleasant break from quotidian reality. During that time, being a serious runner who enjoyed being drunk seldom caused problems. Occasionally, I'd tell myself I'd make a good alcoholic, one of the most bizarre life goals one can set, because I never neglected school or work or running. In my sophomore year of college, I tied for first in a then-personal record at a half marathon while still loopy from the previous evening. The few times a year I got throw-up drunk, I'd have great runs the next day. I'd float along for 10 to 15 miles, feeling light and cleaned out while thinking, what kind of disincentive is this? Following a late afternoon track workout with beers, often without eating first, to hasten the buzz, resulted in feeling no different the next day than if I ate a good dinner and went to bed early. I was more or less indefatigable and really fit from several years of 70 to 100-mile weeks. Drinking had no discernible effect on my recovery or progress. I continued to set PRs through my late 20s, some of which amazed me, like 51 minutes 1 second for 10 miles, or faster per mile than I'd run for 2 miles in high school. Many of my running friends had much the same relationship with alcohol, including an apparent lack of negative consequences. But here's the conclusion of William James's quote. It is part of the deeper mystery and tragedy of life that whiffs and gleams of something that we immediately recognize as excellent should be vouchsafed to so many of us only in the fleeting earlier phases of what, in its totality, is so degrading a poison. At some point in my 30s, I went from drinking when I felt good to drinking to feel better. An old album title by the band Spot 1019, This World Owes Me a Buzz, came to mind mid-afternoon most days. By then, I'd been diagnosed with dysthymia and was usually taking an antidepressant. Intellectually, I knew regular consumption of a central nervous system depressant was among the worst things I could do for my mental health. But the pull of those former seemingly consequence-free times under the sway of the yes function was so enticing. That meant drinking more often, which of course meant needing to drink more for the same effect. When I began to notice others noticing my drinking, I more regularly drank liquor for quicker effect, and I began to drink alone more often. Like Cartalia, I told myself I had my drinking under control because I didn't miss runs or work. I knew I was lying to myself. I would take Do You Have a Drinking Problem quizzes online. Have you ever felt that you should cut down on your drinking? Have people annoyed you by criticizing your drinking? And pass, or fail, depending on how you look at it. I would always come up with a yeah, but response to the questions. For example, people do a lot of things that annoy me. Why does that mean I'm in trouble with alcohol? But in moments of non-defensive honesty, I knew what the truth was. As things continued to deteriorate, I began drinking secretly. I'd stash easily hidden, easily chugged 50-milliliter bottles of vodka in the attic or my clothes chest. When my wife realized this was happening, I hid liquor outside the house, often in spots I'd stop at in the last mile of a run. I was disgusted with myself, not just for how much time and mental energy I spent thinking about drinking, but even more so for regularly lying to and disappointing my wife. Things had obviously been heading in the wrong direction for a long time. The future looked even bleaker. The day before Thanksgiving 2008, I had my first session with Brooks. After several months that were harder than anything I'd ever done in running, I stopped drinking in the summer of 2009. Being a runner, in some ways, went hand in hand with my drinking. Being a runner then became instrumental in quitting drinking. Brooks recommended that I use cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, to succeed on any given day in not drinking. For example, when the thought, "This world owes me a buzz," popped up, I would examine it. What was behind that thought, and was it valid? Some days I'd tell myself, "Can the self-pity? You're healthy. You're married to the best person you're ever going to meet. You're not destitute, and are unlikely ever to be. You don't have to work in an office, and there's ice cream in the freezer." Many days I'd decide, "Yes, you do deserve to feel better than you have the last several hours, but is alcohol the right way to meet that goal? The evidence is overwhelming that it's not. Even if you felt good after drinking, it would last for maybe 20 minutes. Drinking tonight doesn't hold up to the cost-benefit analysis." My main point in Chapter 7 was that runners naturally use CBT all the time. We won't last long in the sport if we give up every time a run feels too far or too fast, or schedules and weather present challenges. Decades of experience in not granting thoughts immediate legitimacy made applying this technique to not drinking much easier than it otherwise would have been. The second key way that running helped me stop drinking was that I milked the all-or-nothing mentality running can encourage for good, not ill. At first, I tried returning to light social drinking. That led to eternal internal questions. Is it okay to have a second beer? Is it too soon to have a glass of wine after having a beer 4 days ago? What happens if tomorrow we go to another party? Why am I really having this drink? Mulling these questions was far more trouble than any pleasure the drink provided. So, I switched my goal to living alcohol-free, and the mindset needed to achieve that goal was instantly familiar. Decades ago, I realized it's easier for me to run every day unless I'm injured or sick. I think about only when and where, not whether, to run. Applied to alcohol, that habit of mind means I don't waste any energy deciding if I'm going to drink today. Finally, running has taught me how to navigate day-to-day difficulties while working toward a long-term goal. Running requires faith that your efforts are going to pay off, even though setbacks and futility are common. J. Carson Smith, Ph.D., a brain researcher at the University of Maryland, says that regular running should build psychological resilience along with a stronger brain. You've been through a lot of situations where you had to push yourself, and you've dealt with adversity, maybe even injury and recovery from injury, all these things that set you back, he says. But you've been able to come through it and succeed, or at least continue. Those times are hopefully life lessons that we take into tough situations. When I first stopped drinking, I became more depressed than I'd been in a long time. Brooks told me my brain's reward system had more or less been given a bye for several years and needed to relearn how to work. I knew the severity of what I was experiencing was transient, and that, like persevering through a difficult training period, I'd emerge on the other end stronger. In the meantime, I upped my mileage and ran with friends more often to get more of a daily mood boost. A big chocolate chip cookie at night also helped. After a few months, avoiding the temptation of alcohol became much easier because I simply stopped thinking about drinking. I wish I could report that my running improved dramatically once I stopped drinking. Other than not waking up dehydrated as often, I didn't notice much change. My life, however, improved immensely. Mostly, I felt liberated now that the thoughts and behaviors that took up so much time and mental space aren't part of my existence. Meanwhile, most of the people I ran and drank with 20 years ago remain dedicated to both. All but Cartelia, who incidentally doesn't have depression or anxiety, declined to speak openly with me on the topic. But trust me that the 10 miles in the morning, 6 beers at night runner is very much a thing. You may have reached your TMI limit a while ago. I wanted to go into this level of detail for a few reasons. First, as my effort to destigmatize openness about problem drinking. Second, as a counterexample to the binary exercise or drugs rubric often heard. Finally, as a reminder that while running is a powerful tool for managing your depression or anxiety, it's not necessarily a cure-all. That last notion, what running can and can't do for mental health, is the subject of the final chapter. Chapter 12. What running can and can't do. Because we're going to save the world, my wife and I reuse the plastic bags we store produce in. Doing so entails rinsing the bags and then hanging them over the faucet to dry. One night in February 2011, I was midway through bag rinsing when I suddenly stopped. I put my hands on the counter, lowered my head, and sighed, "I can't do this anymore." I slumped out of the kitchen to lie down on our bed. As it turned out, the next day I had an appointment with my therapist. Frank Brooks and I were 2 years past overcoming my drinking problem, but still seeing each other regularly about the root problem of depression. I started to relate my bag-rinsing crisis and felt increasingly ridiculous the more I told the tale. I paused the narrative and said, "I mean, it's not about the plastic bag, it's..." Brooks interrupted and said, "Scott, it's never about the plastic bag." Becoming overwhelmed by the environmental pointlessness of reusing this one plastic bag was akin to the cellular-level sadness I felt in ninth grade, reading about the 24-hour life cycle of mayflies. The mayfly incident confused me. The bag incident inspired me. I now had enough experience with depression to know it was a warning that things were out of balance. At a time when I was writing a book while working full-time, trying to get through the main winter, and having your garden variety middle-age existential crisis, sessions with Brooks and running with friends weren't enough. Hearing "it's never about the plastic bag" prompted a discussion that led to going back on antidepressants. We've seen throughout this book the profound benefits of running for people with depression or anxiety. My life would be immeasurably worse if I'd not discovered it in 1979. Sometimes, however, running's not enough. Like the spouse who reminds you she's not responsible for your happiness, running should be valued as a wellspring of support, not something you outsource your well-being to. In this final chapter, we'll look at how to keep running in perspective and how to know when you need more than running to manage your mental health. When running's not enough. Many people can adequately manage their depression or anxiety primarily through running. In Chapter 5, we met runners who, for a variety of reasons, have decided antidepressants aren't for them. others forego seeing a counselor because they feel they can keep their symptoms under adequate control without devoting time, money, and mental energy to regular therapy. Cecilia Bidwell, an attorney from Tampa, hasn't ever received an official diagnosis for anxiety. After researching her symptoms, she discussed them with her gynecologist, who agreed that what Bidwell was describing sounded like anxiety. Bidwell refused the gynecologist's offer of a referral to a specialist. Before a minor medical procedure, Bidwell told the anesthetist, "She sometimes felt like her heart was racing." He looked at my heart and said, "You're in amazing shape. I wish everyone I put under were as fit as you. But I do think you have anxiety." Bidwell then discussed her symptoms with a friend who's a psychiatrist. I said, "If I don't run, I can't control it. But if I can get out and run for an hour, hour and a half every day and get enough sleep, I can keep things under control." Bidwell has remained resistant to other interventions. "This is something about who I am," she says about her standard mental state. "I don't want to dilute it. So long as I can run and sleep, I can handle it." Rich Harfst of Annandale, Virginia, has also landed on running as his main treatment. He's occasionally taken antidepressants or seen a counselor to address the depression that's been with him since he was a teen more than 3 decades ago. He didn't like the side effects from medication, including the weight gain that could interfere with being competitive in his age group. More broadly, "I don't want being on medication to become my norm. I want to have that safety net in case I go below my norm." While in the Army, Harfst didn't establish a long-term relationship with a therapist because he moved so frequently. "If I was in a new place, I had to start all over with explaining my situation to a new doctor and going through the whole process from ground zero," he says. "That was frustrating to do, particularly if I was in a depressed state, so I just didn't do it." His wife, Jennifer, says that Harfst has another disincentive, even now that he's settled geographically. "There's a point to which it's beneficial, but then there's a point where it's the opposite of beneficial. It's throwing in his face the stuff that's making him depressed in the first place. It's neither a failure of running nor the runner to consider additional treatment. I have my own bias. I love running, but no, I wouldn't want to say that running is a cure for everything," says clinical psychologist Laura Fredendahl. Just as a well-rounded training program includes elements that build on one another, some studies have found better outcomes when exercise is combined with medication and/or professional consultations. Usually these studies involve people who are getting traditional therapy but are still significantly affected by depression or anxiety. Then, some of the subjects start exercising regularly and show improvements in symptoms and functioning in as few as 6 weeks. It's reasonable to think the reverse order, adding other treatments to an already established running regimen, can be just as powerful. Sapita Saremi, a therapist who incorporates running into her practice, says, "I'm all about the lowest minimum dose. If the running works, do the running. But sometimes the running is not enough. When I was postpartum and really depressed and couldn't run, I did a lot of therapy. I still do therapy now, even with being back to running. I'm for people getting what they need, and whatever that looks like, I think that's fine." Deciding when running's not enough is usually a judgment call. Clinical psychiatrist and runner Brian Vasey says, "One key thing to evaluate is how well you're functioning in day-to-day life. Are you able to do what you need to do and experience life to the depths that you would hope?" he says. "Are you experiencing joy and pleasure? Do you feel genuinely socially engaged? Are you feeling meaning in your life? Are you feeling like a contributing member of society and feeling good about that?" Fredendahl also says that quality of life is the best guide. If running isn't enough, maybe your relationships aren't working, or you're still losing or gaining weight, or not sleeping, or not managing anger, or not performing in work or school, she says. The dialogue with yourself or someone else about what's occurring in your life is so important. An objective observer can be extremely helpful, someone who can ask, "Are you still not feeling good? Is exercise not enough? Vasey acknowledges that making that judgment call of when to supplement your running can be challenging. If someone's been dealing with anxiety or depression a long time, they may have developed ways of coping and managing so that they can function well enough, he says. Lifelong sufferers might not know any other way of navigating the world. One key is a change in your functioning. When I had an existential crisis over rinsing a plastic bag, it was irrefutable evidence that something had shifted. What had worked for me the past few years, running, regular therapy, living alcohol-free, was no longer enough. If people are living life, they're exposed to stress and loss and life events that are going to be difficult to manage, Vasey says. That could lead to symptoms that, if they were to last more than a few weeks, would be diagnostic of a disorder. If I'm having problems with work and my mother just died and I'm not running because I have an injury, I'm not going to sleep as well. I'm going to be more irritable and so on. If in the context of all these other things you're having these symptoms, it might be worth considering if you need extra help. Are you overly reliant on running? One life event that might cause greater than normal symptoms is losing your linchpin, running, because of injury. It can be difficult, bordering on impossible, not to assume the worst. Sure, you've been hurt before and overcame it, but really, this time is different, the episode that will mark the end of the running career you've envisioned for yourself. Adding to the angst is that your usual main source of psychological well-being is now a major source of worry and woe. All runners have these feelings when they're hurt, especially when the injury is bad enough to merit taking time off. A 2017 review of research on exercise withdrawal looked at what happened to people's mental health when they suddenly stopped working out. Yes, you heard that right. These studies gathered a group of regular exercisers and were able to convince half of them to voluntarily do no exercise from anywhere from 1 to 6 weeks. A thought experiment. How much would you have to be paid to not exercise for 6 weeks? The researchers found that the suddenly sedentary subjects consistently showed depressive symptoms, including fatigue, tension, confusion, lower self-esteem, insomnia, and irritability, and an increase in general anxiety. The researchers also found that longer bouts of no workouts caused more of these symptoms in regular exercisers, with 2 weeks seeming to mark a threshold of significance. Remember that these were people who voluntarily stopped exercising. Your reaction is likely to be even greater with injury, when ceasing to run isn't your choice. In addition, your withdrawal symptoms will probably be greater the more important you consider running to be to your well-being. A Brazilian study involving highly committed and more casual runners found that the first group had more depression, anger, and fatigue than the second group at the end of 2 weeks without exercise. How do you distinguish between injury blues that are acceptable and those that might indicate over-reliance on running for your mental health? An example of the former is Fredendall's description of a lengthy bout with a hamstring injury. I've never been depressed, she says, but I did notice that when I couldn't run for 3 months, that my work became more difficult. I wasn't concentrating as well, and I was feeling a little burnt out, even though I love my work. Contrast that with the blunt statement of Kristen Barry, who uses running to manage depression. I am overly reliant on it, she says. If I am unable to run due to injury, I sometimes am miserable. It's definitely not healthy. If the feelings are so significant that they interfere with your life, you might be overly reliant on running to buttress your mental health, according to Brooks. Ideally, mood is pretty even across all situations and areas of functioning, including running, he says. If something stops, you shouldn't plunge into a depression or feel more anxious. You might feel less fit, and you might feel, I really miss that, but it shouldn't affect your mood so much that your functioning suffers significantly. You might already have evidence whether you're leaning too much on running. According to Fredendall, Training through injury because you're afraid of becoming depressed or anxious indicates that you're overly reliant on running to manage your mental health. That would be a sign that there's something going on that's worth looking at, she says. Amelia Gappin articulates that situation well. For somebody who relies on running for mental health, when you're injured, the first thing you think is, oh no, how do I compensate for this now? And then it's not just that you're not running and don't have this thing that helps. You also have in your head, now I'm not training, I'm further from my goal. You get these new things that start feeding into the depression and anxiety, and that makes it so much worse. I don't have a good way to handle that, Gappin says. The worst part is that a lot of times it pushes me to run when I shouldn't. I either run through injury, or I don't respect the early warning signs and tell myself I can run through this one. If I were smart or didn't have these other issues, it'd be easier to take 2 days off and keep something from getting worse. Elite ultramarathoner Rob Krar also acknowledges that he sometimes pushes the injury envelope because of his reliance on running to help with depression. I'm 41 and been running for a long time, so I feel like I always have niggles or something going on I need to keep an eye on, he says. It's important for me to feel good overall most days. I'm willing to take a little bit more of a risk for the sake of feeling good about myself, even though I'm running through something somebody else might take time off for. Krar says that over the years, he's mostly learned how to strike the right balance. I'm now more aware of when I'm going over the line and when getting out for a run is only going to make things worse. My happiness can't depend solely on my running. Acknowledging that has been very important for me to help minimize the risk of injury and falling off track in my training and racing. A corollary to running through injury because you need the miles to manage your mood is running so much that your running suffers. Allie Nolan went through such a period between 2014 and 2016. I was obsessive about running and thought the reason I was feeling so down, so anxious, so out of control was because I wasn't running hard or long enough. In the spring of 2016, when I was running twice a day because I couldn't stay focused on anything except running, I started to feel exhausted. I noticed that my coping mechanism might not be working. Running itself was becoming a source of compulsion and anxiety. While on vacation in Mexico, Nolan finally crashed. She began taking medication and reassessed her relationship with running. Nowadays, I'm a lot more lax with my daily mileage and training plans. I use running when I need a break or to focus, she says. Keeping running in perspective. Your running doesn't have to go off the rails for you to be overly reliant on it. The opposite can occur, where running goes so well that you practice a sort of willful ignorance about the rest of your life. My late 20s were my fastest running years. I had always found setting personal bests to be highly motivating, much more so than racing for place. At my level at that time, where I finished in a race was mostly determined by who did, and more important, didn't, show up on a given day. Sometimes I won, sometimes I was 12th, sometimes I was 3rd. There were certain guys I was supposed to beat, but not because I'm by nature competitive or felt superior to them. They usually finished behind me, so unless I'd seen that they'd recently made a big leap forward, if they beat me, it meant I'd not run as close to my potential that day as I should have. An inherent need to conquer others just because we're engaged in the same pursuit isn't one of my defining personality traits. But running faster than ever before, to me, that's captivating. Once I got my 10K PR into the 31:40s, I set the goal of breaking 31 minutes for the distance. In high school, my first big-time goal had been to break 5 minutes in the mile. Breaking 31 for 10K would mean doing so for 6.2 miles. I liked how the numbers of that comparison sounded, as well as the thought of how my capabilities had increased in the decades since high school. I knew, to accomplish this goal, I needed to up my mileage set point. Over several months, I got to where I could regularly run 100 miles a week and still have my twice-weekly hard workouts and weekend long run be of the same quality they'd been at 70 to 80 miles a week, which had been my norm the preceding several years. When, in the fall of 1991, I ran 30:57 at a 10K road race, I was my version of ecstatic, which is not so much fist-pumping and beaming as a quiet, internal contentment over meeting a personally meaningful goal. Putting in the work to break 31 minutes made me feel almost indefatigable when running. Usually I just sort of floated along at around 6-minute, 30-second mile pace until it was time to stop. Running had always been a special time for me, but now the day's one or two runs often became the highlight. I felt a certain sense of mastery that was more satisfying than anything else in my life. And that's where the warning should have come in. Ideally, the empowerment I got from running would have helped me in other parts of my life, when, as often was the case, work, relationships, or just general existence seemed pointless or stagnant, I should have been able to tell myself to stay hopeful and keep plugging away, because what had happened in my running could happen elsewhere. Instead, I just ignored things. When I felt the familiar deflated yearning for a more satisfying life, I would tell myself, "Come on, you broke 31 minutes. How bad can things really be?" As a result, I was often miserable for most of my non-running hours, including when trying to sleep. And seeing lack of progress in other parts of my life mostly spurred me to focus that much more on running, the one area where I consistently felt capable of making the world like I wanted it to be. At work, I'd think about where and how far to run come quitting time. On weekends, I was happy to drive however far to run with others, because then I wouldn't get home until noon, meaning less time to fill before my afternoon run. The end of my runner's fantasy camp began on a high note, with a win in March 1993 at a prestigious local 20K. I decided to keep the positive momentum going and aim to surpass what was then the highest mileage week of my life, 123 miles. After 6 days, I had 108 miles. Unfortunately, also after 6 days, a freak mid-March blizzard hit the Washington, D.C. area. I slipped and slid through a ridiculous 11-miler in the morning, and then an even more ridiculous 6-miler in the evening to end the week with 125 miles. Instead of celebrating this accomplishment, I decided to surpass it the following week. The next day, while doing 2 runs totaling 20 miles on slick roads, my right Achilles tendon started throbbing. The day after that, I couldn't run without limping and severe pain. In less than 48 hours, I'd gone from the peak of my powers to immobility. As the 0-mile days continued, I fell into a deep depression, compounded by my longtime girlfriend having recently dumped me. I recall lying on my bed watching melting blizzard snow flood my basement apartment and thinking, "That's a shame. Wish I cared enough to do something about it." The right relationship with running. I'd like to think I would handle that disappointment differently now. Indeed, in 2013, I didn't run for 5 months before and after foot surgery and kept functioning at an acceptable level. That's not because I care less about running than I did 25 years ago. If anything, I cherish running now more than ever. More time as a runner with depression means more clarity on how my marriage, friendships, work, physical health, and, of course, mental health are all so much better than they'd otherwise be if I didn't average an hour of running a day. More time as a runner with depression has also allowed me to love running without smothering it. It's up to me, not running, not my wife, not work or novels or music or anything else, to cultivate the best Scott that's possible with the neurochemical hand I've been dealt. As with any good relationship, that with running needs to be nurtured. The last time I failed significantly in that regard was at the beginning of the decade. For more than a year, I tried to finesse my way through foot pain, mostly because I had taken on too much work and needed the stress relief I thought only running could provide. For reasons that make no sense to me now, I also decided to race a marathon for the first time in a dozen years. The 2012 Philadelphia Marathon became yet another second-half debacle. Running with zombie form the last several miles furthered the damage to my foot. But I wanted to capitalize on the fitness I'd squandered in the marathon and tried to get back to normal training as soon as possible. Soon, I was limping while running. Every day, the state of my foot got me more depressed, so every day I headed out to run on it to temporarily abate that depression. By that January, things were so bad that I finally had the clarity to stop running. After I had peroneal tendon surgery in April 2013, the orthopedist told me I'd never run more than 25 miles a week. This was a distressing prediction, given that I'd averaged more than twice that since 1979. I didn't vow then and there in the recovery room to prove him wrong, but I was pretty sure his figure wasn't strongly backed by data. I hoped I'd be able to get back more toward that hour a day of running that elevates the other 23 hours. Since then, my top running goal every year is to miss no days to injury. This is not the call to obsessiveness or ignoring my body it might sound like. I don't run if pain or tightness interferes with my normal stride. I've learned once and for all that's going to make prolonged injury more likely, especially now that my lifetime odometer is past 110,000 miles. Instead, miss no days to injury is really code for give back to running so that it can keep helping you. It's how I get myself to incorporate self-care into my daily routine. Stretching, strengthening, yoga, running form drills, not sitting for too long at once, eating well, staying at a good weight, not getting too exhausted, these all help me have a body that can hold up to the amount of running that supports my mental health. Some of these areas of attention, such as diet and sleep, have their own depression-fighting benefits. Miss no days to injury also means not taking unnecessary risks of too sudden jumps in mileage or intensity. Yet, it also entails regularly incorporating variety in distance, speed, surface, shoes, and solo versus group runs to combat physical and mental staleness. This system has served me well. Since 2014, I've missed only a handful of days to injury. I've averaged close to 60 miles a week in that time and finished my first ultramarathon. More important, I've gotten running's unrivaled daily and cumulative help with managing lifelong depression, while feeling that the current state of my running is sustainable for many years to come. When, on March 1st, I mark my running anniversary, I do so with fondness, recalling the many people I've run with, the running paths we've taken together, and the conversations and experiences we've shared. And I look ahead to more years of joint discoveries. I hope that some of the ideas presented in this book help you find a similarly satisfying and therapeutic relationship with running. On your more difficult days, I hope that something you've heard here helps you get out the door and make the day better than it otherwise would be. The key to feeling better is taking that first step. Appendix. Quick tips on using running to manage mental health. Any run is better than no run when it comes to short-term mood improvement or long-term help with depression and anxiety. But some runs are more effective than others. Here's some brief guidance on how best to get a post-run boost. Most of these topics are covered in greater detail in Chapter 4. How far? Most studies find significant mood boosts after 30 minutes of running. Improvements in mood tend to last longer after longer runs. But a 20-minute run is much closer to a 90-minute run than it is to not running. Avoid all-or-nothing thinking about duration or distance, such as that a real run has to be at least 5 miles long or it's not worth doing. The most important step on any day is the first one, the one that gets you out the door. On tough mental days, Start your run with a flexible route that you can shorten or lengthen as feels best. How fast? Research has found the greatest increase in get happy brain chemicals following moderate intensity workouts. In running terms, that's your basic getting in the miles effort at a conversational pace. But there's more to mood than brain chemical levels. Pushing yourself through a hard workout provides a needed sense of setting and accomplishing a goal. At the other end of the spectrum, give yourself permission to run as slowly as you want on especially tough mental days. Again, the most important thing about any one run is that it happens. Where? People usually report better mood improvement, more tranquility, greater reduction in stress, anxiety, and depression when running in natural settings compared with populated human-made environments. Of course, schedules and geography usually get in the way of regularly running through paradise. Choose visually interesting routes with minimal traffic as often as possible. When time allows, make an effort to run in beautiful settings for an above and beyond boost. When? Plan to run whenever you're most likely to actually run most of the time. Many runners with depression and anxiety especially value morning runs because they set a positive tone and provide an example of success for the rest of the day. With whom? Assuming you have options on whether to run solo or with others, opt for whichever setup feels right for the day. Running by yourself can work best when you need to think through an issue with the help of that special on-the-run clarity. A solo run before or after a hectic day will probably also be more calming. Run with others when you need a break from your internal monologue or would benefit from talking through things with trusted friends. And if you're struggling to activate, schedule runs with others to increase the chances of getting out the door. With what purpose? Regularly mixing up all of the mentioned variables should keep your running more interesting, which will make consistently going for runs more likely, which will mean greater mental health benefits. Having runs of different length, intensity, and setting within each week also helps free you from the common thinking trap that all your days are the same. This concludes Running is My Therapy by Scott Douglas, narrated by Stephen R. Thorne. Copyright 2018 by Scott Douglas. Forward copyright 2018 by Allison Mariella Desir. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with The Experiment, LLC, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.